Welcome Underground, and welcome to the first in an occasional series where we slightly chaotically go through each Discworld novel in turn to see what thoughts they can spark. First up is The Colour of Magic, in which Rincewind the Wizard encounters a tourist from the Far East. We end up talking about tourism, magic, and the fact that pulp fantasy is a true descendant of the Homeric tradition, the more legit literature. Enjoy.
I can't think of any other standalone parody book. Can you?
Standalone parody book. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a. I mean, if you give me time and a Google, so 10 minutes on Google, I might be able to come up with something.
Yeah.
But no, I take your point. Yeah, yeah.
But it's the only successful parody ever written, perhaps. So, and I think that's probably, and the only way of actually writing a fantasy novel, because these days, like, I mean, fantasy has kind of been done.
Yeah.
Oh, it certainly had been in the '80s, and that's why he was just writing a piss take. And even then, like the great fantasy book, because like any fantasy book is basically Tolkien remixed. Any high fantasy book, but if you think like Tolkien wrote his books as he created the Elven language first, didn't he? And then wrote some lore, you know, giving background to that language. But then, you know, the Hobbit was just written to kind of, you know, do something with it. And I was reading actually Conan the Barbarian, who is parodied a little bit in The Colour of Magic and a bit more in Light Fantastic. That's in a fantasy setting just because the author grew up in rural Texas where the libraries weren't very good, so he just didn't have enough background to be able to write historical fiction, which he wanted to do, so he had to just create a fantasy world so he could keep it consistent.
Yeah.
It seems that no one really sets out to write a fantasy novel. I guess more recently you've got things like George R. R. Martin, which is, you know, Tolkien but dark, and the Witcher series, which is Tolkien but, you know, in Eastern Europe.
Well, I think that the immediately drawing attention to Tolkien is right, because of course, as you pointed out there, Tolkien spent a lot of time really doing the work of filling out the background of his world. He did it linguistically, as you said, but also he was very, very deeply engrossed in Norse, Old English, mythology.
Well, he published his Beowulf translation before The Hobbit.
Exactly, you know, he was really, really
and Gawain the Green Knight. Yeah.
Niche Germanic, sort of medieval, early medieval, even pre-then sort of stuff. Really immersed in it. He really was an expert in it, and he decided quite consciously to, out of all of that material and out of all of that knowledge, create a new mythic world and a new mythic cycle. And the reason, I think that, you know, one of the reasons why he's been so utterly transformative on literature and culture is because, you know, those stories emerged from that incredibly deep well of real knowledge of traditions of storytelling and myth and folklore. And actually, I think Pratchett is similar in that regard, because he also had deep knowledge of these things from having just read it voraciously as a child,
but I guess also meta level, where he had the deep knowledge of folklore and all that, but also deep knowledge of the fantasy genre, the fantasy fiction, which immediately adds another level to things, so that he's familiar both with the source material and what people have done with it.
Mm.
And so he's not so much reacting to the real world source material as reacting to what people have done with it, the stories they've told using those inspirations.
Yeah, so when he publishes this very first novel in the series, as I said, didn't know it was going to be a series at this point, but it's emerging from, it's not just some sort of it's not a trivial thing that he's done. It's emerged from his life and from the contents of his of deep knowledge.
Well, and it's not a trivial book, because if you think about it, most of the concepts and characters and organizations and scenes that you know, are the subject of the following 40 books are introduced in The Colour of Magic. Like, it's, you know, they only come on very quickly, but he covers a lot of ground. You've got the wizards, you've got the university, you've got Ankh-Morpork and how that works and the technological development, and then, you know, you've got a whole load of the geography, you've got death. The gods.
Sort of the beginnings of the dungeon dimensions, although dungeon dimensions not mentioned. Lovecraft is very much there, with the Sender of Eight. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so actually...
And magic as well, you know, of course, just magic in general in the world. And just the world itself. The world itself is fully imagined, really. It comes out of
it's sketched. So it's like Tolkien had a really in-depth idea of the world he was creating before he wrote a book. Terry Pratchett probably made it up as he went along, but he made up so much as he wrote this one book that that was an adequate basis for a 40-book series.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually, about that. I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the right way
to think about it. Just happened to work. It's a very compelling world. He just happened to to dash off.
Yeah. So
as a joke.
Yeah, exactly. But you're right. It's not just a joke, is it? It's not trivial. It really, really isn't trivial. And that's why I think that, you know, when I read it, it was the first book I read of Pratchett. I didn't think it was a parody at all. And that's partly because I didn't have the knowledge of...
Well, that's another thing, of course, is that the reader in 2024 hasn't read all the stuff that Terry Pratchett in 1983 is reacting to. Mm. In fact, I only read my first Conan the Barbarian story like yesterday in preparation for this because he is parodied so hard. And it's like, I haven't read it, but you don't need to read it really because the concepts are all out there. But the specific references go mostly over our heads. The book's divided into four sections. Each one is parodying a specific thing.
Yeah. We can go through what they are. Do you want me to go through what they are? Because I've done my research too.
Please do.
Well, the first one, the first section is where the two barbarians, Bravd and Weasel, are parodies of Fritz Leiber's fantasy heroes, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. And the stories in which they star, which are collected in the Sword series of books, were first published in 1939.
Mm.
Yeah. Deep background. But of course, I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea when I first picked up the Colour of Magic.
The third section, which is about dragons. I mean, again, the specific reference to Dragon Riders of Pern. I mean, no one's read that for a long time.
No. Yeah. I mean, people read Lovecraft, don't they? That's the specifics behind the Sender of Eight, that section. But
But in many ways, that kind people. Of...
Yeah.
The 70s, 80s time, it was an interesting moment because it was a resurgence, I think, of books that had been forgotten. And as you say, Grey Mouser published in the 30s, and I think it was largely forgotten until it was resurrected in the 70s. Ditto, again, Conan the Barbarian. That wasn't reprinted following their initial publication in like pulp magazines in the 30s again until the 70s.
And Pratchett himself talks about how this was a kind of underground tradition, because he says how he had to really work to get his hands on all of this stuff, and he was just hooked by it. But it wasn't as if it was freely available.
They had these kind of secret bookshops that did kind of almost samizdat or like imported American books and things like that. So it would normally be like porn and fantasy being sold by the same shopkeeper in the same manner.
Mm.
It wasn't out in the open. It was all fanzines and then you get later Terry Pratchett being very active on these kind of niche Usenet groups in the early internet.
Yeah.
And now it's quite odd that, I guess, geek culture, which is a very, very shallow version of what Terry Pratchett was engaging in the 80s, but it's quite mainstream now.
Yeah.
It wasn't then.
Well, back then, he was sort of imbibing the waters of an underground river that had almost petered out. You know, he was really a sort of somebody who was engaged in unearthing a cultural stream that was almost out of sight at that point. And then suddenly...
Tolkien, before the Lord of the Rings films, I have a dim recollection of it being quite niche. Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a lot more culturally niche before the films. Certainly. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you had the cartoons, didn't you? And you had that wonderful Soviet version.
Wonderful is the word for that.
But anyway, I suppose my point is that when I first read it, I had no idea about any of this stuff. Absolutely none. And it didn't... While obviously it was obvious that it was intended to be humorous rather than serious, it was obvious that it was not intended to be high literature with all of the pretensions that go with it. It was intended to be humorous. It didn't strike me as a trivial parody, something that was purely parasitical.
Yeah, it didn't rely on knowing the original works to work as either humor or as a satisfying narrative.
And actually, I think that I assumed that the humour was there as just a way into the sort of the deeper territory that he wanted to explore.
Well, I didn't think about it twice. I mean, it's okay to write a funny book. Like, yeah, funny books are great.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're good at it, I mean, it's hard. You don't get many, but...
Yeah, I suppose, in my mind, it's a bit like the, you know, it's like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is actually how it was originally marketed, as, you know, the new Douglas Adams. Yeah, it was in the... it was on the front cover of the original edition or something like that. It was a reference to The Hitchhiker's Guide, or it was very much in the early reviews. And obviously, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a very humorous book, but it's about serious themes in one sense. Mm. It's a commentary. You know, it's more like satire than it is parody. And I suppose I conceived of it in that tradition as a sort of satire that's actually going after quite big game.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that becomes more prominent in later books where it's holding its mirror up to reality rather than to the fantasy genre.
Yeah.
And then you can see, that the parodies are of, you know, Shakespeare plays or...
I think that I would argue that even The Colour of Magic, even this first one, is holding a mirror up to reality. It's like Pratchett can't help it. It's built into what he was producing. So he might have thought, I'm going to hold a mirror up to this fantasy genre and that's what I'm going to do. But almost, perhaps it was voluntary, perhaps it was involuntarily. Nevertheless, it was woven into it at the start, holding up a mirror to reality itself.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's just how he writes.
That's just what he's about. Yeah. Should we talk about what actually happens in The Colour of Magic?
And
go from there.
Well, do you want to give a plot synopsis?
Yeah, okay. I'll give it my best shot.
Because you have read it twice in the last week, so
yeah, so I should be able to do it, shouldn't I? Well, basically we start off with Two Flower turning up in the docks in Ankh-Morpork, which is the city, which is sort of a mishmash of, I think I've read one scholar. He says it's a mishmash of London, Victorian London, Renaissance Italian city-state, and Los Angeles.
that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's the kind of archetypal city. We talked a little bit about that in the previous episode. And he rocks up there, and he's got loads and loads of gold. He's got a mysterious... piece of luggage that has its own little legs and a mind of its own. It's very dangerous. And he turns up and basically he's a tourist. He wants to come and he wants to look at the famous Ankh-Morpork and meet its heroes and experience all of its you know, native sites and its interesting points and all of this kind of stuff. And he's incredibly wealthier than anybody who's there, any of the locals, and he immediately starts causing chaos through his naivety, through his good intentions, and through his absolutely bizarre desire just to look at things. And I'll quote, this was a this is the patrician talking about he's received a letter from his from the emperor of the Agatian Empire.
Yeah, the patrician is the ruler of Ankh-Morpork.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. He's received a letter from the emperor of the Agatian Empire, which is where Two Flower, the tourist, comes from, and he says, "One such letter arrived this morning. A subject of the emperor appears to have taken it into his head to visit our city. It appears he wishes to look at it. Only a madman would possibly undergo all the privations of crossing the Turnwise Ocean in order to merely look at anything, however." and then Two Flower himself says, "I want to see genuine Morporkian life, the slave market, the whore pits, the temple of the small gods, the beggar's guild, and a genuine tavern brawl." A faint note of suspicion entered Two Flower's voice. "You do have them, don't you? You know, people swinging on chandeliers, sword fights over the table, that sort of thing. Run the Barbarian and the Weasel are always getting involved in, you know, excitement." So that's what he wants. He's there to be a tourist in this kind of mad pastiche, or not really a pastiche, actually quite deep, of a fantasy world called, you know, the Discworld. Two-Flyer is himself from the Discworld, but he's from a different continent, which is separate from the...
Very far away.
Very far away. So, you know, it is like he's a... Well, you know, is he like us? Are we supposed to be sort of focalized through Two-Flyer as tourists visiting this world for the first time?
Yeah, is he the author insert as we're shown around this edifice that Terry Pratchett's built in his mind?
Yeah.
Or are we looking at the tourists and laughing at him?
Or both. Did Pratchett himself know exactly? I don't know.
And he's more than capable of both. I think one of the strengths of Terry Pratchett is his ability to see both sides of an argument and kind of affectionately rib both.
Yeah. Anyway, through various incidents, mostly to do with Two-Flyer, he has solid gold coinage, and you know it's worth, you know, thousands of times more than anything that the locals have in Ankh-Morpork. And you know, through the kind of the chaos, the economic chaos that he introduces through having this pure gold that he gives out to everyone, causes various incidents. The whole of Ankh-Morpork basically burns down as a result of an insurance scam. Two-Flyer is an insurance salesman. He sells some insurance to the landlord of the broken drum pub, and the landlord immediately proceeds to burn down his own pub to commit insurance fraud, and that burns down the whole city. And and at the same time, he's met Rincewind. This is the point. Rincewind is the wizard, in many ways the central character of this novel, and he is a kind of down and out failed wizard who just happens to be good at languages, and that's how he's introduced to Two-Flyer. He's able to translate for him. The patrician, who obviously wants to keep Two-Flyer alive, or at least initially wants to keep Two-Flyer alive, because the emperor, his colleague in the Agatine Empire, has asked him to do so, basically tells Rincewind, you've got to go and keep him alive. Just keep him alive. And, you know, then that way I will keep you alive. and they go on... You know, Rincewind has quite a difficult job keeping Two-Flyer alive, and we have this kind of wonderful series of sort of scrapes that they get into. And that's the first part, really. Did I miss anything out there? I think that was pretty
well. That was commendably thorough, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, actually, that the synopsis of this first part of the book, the first quarter, took a lot longer than I think the next three quarters.
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, the maybe we can get to the other three quarters in time. But I think that what do you want to talk about first? Do you want to talk about the notion of tourism or the notion of magic?
Let's talk about the notion of tourism.
Okay. So, obviously, there's a critique of tourism in general in this first part of the novel, because, you know, the notion of the Western tourist visiting a different part of the world where, you know, they are comparatively astronomically rich and they're there to do something that makes no sense at all to the locals, which is just to see and experience a culture. Of course, to the locals, because this isn't a concept that makes any sense at all. And... you know, the hilarity and chaos ensues, and obviously there is a comment on tourism there in general, and maybe from 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I'm not sure that the Westerners are quite so much richer anymore than the rest of the world.
Yeah, sadly.
so there's that first of all. And you know, on one level, this is an exploration of the effect of tourism upon societies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even if you take us out of the fantasy world, I mean, it's extremely unnerving when you read the rough guide to England. You know, these guidebooks are used to sort of travel around foreign countries and go on holiday with. When you see what people are reading when they're visiting the UK, it's actually quite alarming. And like, people are coming all this way to see things that we think of as very mundane. Well, one of the things I really worry about in life is, if you're in London, you go to like Piccadilly and Leicester Square and Covent Garden. There's just like thousands of tourists just standing around looking at stuff. And these are very boring places. There's nothing there. They're not even particularly architecturally interesting. They're just places that tourists, you know, want to go to. They want to look at the large video screen on Piccadilly and the random Victorian statue. Or, you know, I don't even know what they do in Leicester Square. but there they were. And my fear is that when I'm in a foreign country on holiday, I'm doing the equivalent.
Yeah.
But in The Colour of Magic, we have Two Flower coming in and doing basically equivalent to standing around in Leicester Square. Obviously, in Discworld, that's more exciting and involves more fighting and prostitutes. But it's still stuff that's completely mundane to any resident.
Yeah. You know what, actually, we're doing this all wrong. We should start off by just talking about what the Discworld is, a great Atwin, rather than getting into tourism and all of that kind of thing. I think that my plan for this episode is wrong. I think the best way to do this is to go through this sequentially.
I did subvert your plan by going to discussion point three first.
No, it's okay. It was a bad plan. Sometimes you've got to... So the best intentions, they don't work, do they? I think the problem is if we try and stick to this plan that I've put together, I was thinking that this discussion needs to be structured because there's a lot in this novel.
There's a lot, and it's been quite a chaotic 20 minutes we've already had.
Yeah. But I think that actually me trying to structure it is just going to make it more chaotic. I think that the simplest way to do this is to just go through it as in a kind of stream of consciousness style. Just start with the beginning. Do you know what I mean? And like,
yeah.
Start with you know, how it opens. Great Atwin.
It's good, yeah, because you said, you know, at the beginning of the book, Two Flower rocks up in Angmore Pork, and that's two stages removed from the beginning of the book.
It is.
We've got the cosmology, and then we've got the framing story.
Yeah, I've tried to be too clever with structuring it. Our conversations can't really be structured, can they? Not really.
No. Got to operate on whim.
Yeah. let's rip up the plan, and let's go to the beginning. I'm going to get the beginning of the book out on my.
It's the same as the beginning of all the Discworld books. Description of a turtle floating through space with four elephants and a world on its back.
Well, that's where we should start then, isn't it?
Yeah. And actually, this is a book in which it matters more than many of the others.
Mm.
In most of Terry Pratchett's books, it's pretty incidental that the world is a disc on the back of four elephants on a turtle. In The Colour of Magic, it actually features in the plot.
Yeah, he falls off the edge at the end.
Yeah.
Well, shall I read out the opening down to the Blue Vault of Heaven? And then we can just talk about that. See what happens.
Let's do it.
Okay. In a distant and second-hand set of dimensions, in an astral plane that was never meant to fly, the curling star mists waver and part. See, great Atwin the turtle comes, swimming slowly through the interstellar gulf, hydrogen frost on his ponderous limbs, his huge and ancient shell pocked with meteor craters. Through sea-sized eyes that are crusted with rheum and asteroid dust, he stares fixedly at the destination. In a brain bigger than a city, with geological slowness, he thinks only of the weight. Most of the weight is, of course, accounted for by Byrillia, Tubal, Great Typhon, and Jerakim, the four giant elephants upon whose broad and star-tanned shoulders the disk of the world rests, garlanded by the long waterfall at its vast circumference and domed by the baby blue vault of heaven. Astropsychology has been, as yet, unable to establish what they think about. That is the opening to The Colour of Magic and the opening to the entire Discworld series. And it's so good. It's just so good. I particularly love the star-tanned shoulders of the elephants. I mean, what a wonderful description that is.
Yeah, the dark truth of Terry Pratchett is he's very funny, but he's also an extremely good writer.
Extremely good. And how good he is comes across in the very few speeches and talks that he's given that we've both read in preparation for this. He's so offhand and self-effacing. He does not try to be clever. He's just humorous and self-effacing and insightful, and he's always right on the mark. And that that brilliant sure-footedness in his style, that inability to be irritatingly pretentious or to try and make himself appear clever. You can see that shot through in the writing there, because it's just enjoyable. It's just purely enjoyable and well-written.
Yeah.
So the great turtle, then, our twin. Hindu, apparently.
Mostly. Well, but I heard another interview with him where he didn't actually know this. And so he was at a book signing like a few years later, and a large Indian family came in. And so you do realize that this is from our, Hindu mythology. He's like, which is what I find fascinating. Like the idea of a world on a turtle back, or even one on elephants on a turtle, is kind of floating around the ether. And as he said, it comes up a lot in a lot of different contexts. It's a weirdly common concept.
I thought it was, I always thought it was a reference to, is it Bertrand Russell? Who was giving a lecture or something on philosophy, and an old lady stood up and said, no, the world is on the back of a turtle. And he said, and what's under that turtle? And then she said, oh, it's turtles all the way down. It's a sort of a famous thing in philosophy, turtles all the way down. I thought it was a reference to that. Was it Bertrand Russell? I have to check that.
Well, it could well be. I mean, there are many sort of narratives you can place on why it's on the back of a turtle. The funniest I heard was that the very fact that the world's a disc and on the back of elephants on the back of a turtle is a riposte to Larry Niven's Ringworld, which is a science fiction series where...
I've read it.
It's very good.
Yeah.
But there you have this world that's being created. It's basically a ring of habitable land that orbits around an artificial star, and that mechanical construction floats through space. And it all just works. Like, the physics has been worked out. And it's all very logical, scientifically valid. And so Terry Pratchett responded to the Ringworld with the Discworld, which is, completely bizarre and only works as held together by magic.
Yeah.
There's
a brilliant line on one of the discussion forums. It was sort of a very wry sort of moderator who was saying that he was talking about the idea that the rim would be warmer than the hub because of the way that the sun orbits it. And he said, actually, somebody wrote in and said they've done the maths, and actually the hub would be warmer than the rim, because on average the sun spends more time closer to the hub.
Well, exactly. That was an early thought I had.
Yeah. But then he says, but don't worry if you don't agree with this, because consensus on how the Discworld actually works is sort of hilariously unachievable. And it's supposed to be achievable.
It's fascinating that someone tried, though, because you get to this question of, well, what is the difference between fantasy and science fiction? And what's the difference between magic and technology? The difference between magic and technology, well, technology, you kind of, it obeys logic and the scientific method, and you know how it works, and there are rules, and if you do this, and that happens. Whilst magic, completely arbitrary chaos. Well,
one way you can conceive of that is that what's the difference between magic and technology? So one exists and one doesn't. And what's the difference between fantasy and science fiction? Is that one could exist and one couldn't. Do you buy that?
Then where do you put something like Star Wars?
Fantasy. I enrage my students by insisting that Star Wars is fantasy, not science fiction.
Well, it's correct. Yeah. I mean, the best explanation for why that is I've heard is that, it matters how the engines of the USS Enterprise work in Star Trek. It does not matter how the engines work on the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, but also, I think that's right. Because the point about science fiction is that it goes to pains to establish the idea that this world that it's built could happen with just X, Y, or Z fictional technologies. And those fictional technologies are expressed in the terms of technology, i.e. something that could conceivably work, that we could imagine working actually in reality. And the better someone does that, and the more detail in which they do that, then the sort of the harder the sci-fi is, its hardness sort of index. So it goes up on the hardness index, that, the better or the more detail that's done.
Yeah, I think that's kind of half of it, but I think that's almost a surface description of the difference between science fiction and fantasy, because Yeah. The stories told in the two genres are very different in that in science fiction, the science matters. Like, how the things work has an impact on the plot. The plot revolves around the science. Whilst in magic, it does not. The magic just happens.
I think that elements, events of the plot in certainly The Colour of Magic require magic in order for those events to happen.
Yes, I guess that's... In Star Trek, for example, you have a whole episode where they need to fuel up the ship because they need a beryllium sphere or whatever it is. Mm. And so they have to go to a planet and there are various procedures to do that. Mm. I don't think there's an equivalent plot in fantasy.
Well, of course, in The Colour of Magic... No, I take that point. But in The Colour of Magic, one of the brilliant ways in which Pratchett subverts the normal notion of magic is he has this idea of the law of the conservation of reality, which is just so brilliant.
Well, that's exactly it. Where I think one of the interesting things about what he's doing here is he's writing a science fiction book in a fantasy universe.
Okay, yeah.
So you've got the fantasy aesthetics, but there's an underlying logic to how the magic works. So it's suddenly not magic, actually, it's technology. Like, magic is treated like technology.
Yeah, so the law of the conservation of reality, just for anybody who's listening who can't remember this bit of the novel, is the idea that the effort used to achieve a particular end should be the same whether you use magic or not. So the rather problematic example that Pratchett provides is that if you want to make some nude virgins appear in your bedroom, then the effort that takes, by the time you've managed it, you'll be sort of half blind and, you know, bewildered from all of the fumes of all the potions and years of study and effort that you've had to do to make it happen. So it's a rather pointless anyway. So that's the idea of the law of the conservation of reality, that the effort has to be the same. And obviously that in itself is a parody of a scientific law, isn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, there are three books called The Science of the Discworld. yeah. Which is extending this parody where all this magic is treated like science. This becomes more important from a plot point of view in later books, especially the wizard ones, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, there we go. There's something already that we've unearthed that's fundamental about Pratchett, which is that he's writing fantasy in a science fiction style. But he himself said that the Discworld is entirely logical. It's just logical about the wrong things. It's logical about the things that we're not accustomed to be logical about. Would you say that's an example of what he meant there?
Yeah, I think so, because a lot of the humour comes from applying logic and rationality to stuff that is fundamentally illogical or irrational.
Yeah.
I think that applies to all his books and all his writing. All the characters are kind of logical extension of a trope to the point where it becomes funny. Or it goes all the way around and becomes profound again.
Yeah, or both, yeah.
yeah.
I mean, I suppose you get that, don't you? Because then immediately after that description that I read out, first of all, you have the astropsychologist trying to work out what, you know, the elephants are thinking about. And then you have the Kingdom of Krull and their astrozoologists who are dangled over the edge. And they're trying to establish the sex of the turtle of Great Arthwen.
Yeah.
So they're sort of scientists within this kind of mad world trying to work it out.
But of course, I mean, yeah, it's funny that all this effort goes into working out the sex of Great Arthwen. But obviously this is a matter of existential importance, because under the Big Bang Theory, where all the turtles are meeting to mate, whether your turtle's going to be on the top or the bottom is survival.
Yeah. Apparently turtles are incredibly hard to determine the sex of. Like, it's down to things like the size of the tail, because their genitalia are internal.
That's of course,
a fun,
yeah.
fun note there. But actually, these astrozoologists are going to have a really, really difficult time, which is a nicely sort of realistic detail.
Yeah, but obviously a detail, yeah, sort of second-level humour.
Yeah.
You know, something that will just occur to you years later.
Yeah.
Reading some random Wikipedia article.
Yeah, exactly. you've obviously referenced the Big Bang Theory, that great pun, and then there's the... What was the other one? It was the steady... Oh, yeah, the uniform cruel or steady gait theory.
Mm.
And then immediately, this is what Pratchett actually says. He's saying that these astrozoologists are speculating about Great Arthurian and what he's doing and where he's going and so forth. And he says there was, for example, the theory that Arthurian had come from nowhere and would continue at a uniform crawl or steady gait into nowhere for all time. This theory was popular among academics. An alternative favoured by those of a religious persuasion was that Arthurian was crawling from the birthplace to the time of mating, as were all the stars in the sky, which were obviously also carried by giant turtles. When they would arrive, they would briefly and passionately mate, and this was the Big Bang, as you said. And that from that fiery union, new turtles would be born to carry a new pattern of worlds. So I just think what I wanted to talk about that is just how he absolutely immediately nails the fact that the steady state theory is more popular among academics, because there is, of course, there's no destination, there's no meaning, there's no direction. And for the religious, of course, there has to be a meaning and a destination. He should immediately hit the nail on the head about two fundamental castes of mind that we encounter every day in our culture. It's just so on the money.
Well, and pointing out the flaws in both, because obviously coming from nowhere and going to nowhere makes no more sense than the Big Bang Theory.
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, and it's just brilliant how even in the first two pages, he's packed so much into there that it's just brilliant.
yeah, that is efficient.
yeah. And it's, there's so much to think about there. It's so rich and dense in terms of meaning. And I think that, that obviously comes from the fact that it's coming from a deep well of stories and archetypes and tropes that Pratchett has imbibed from this, hidden stream of the fantasy tradition.
Yeah, it sounds ridiculous, but it also feels grounded.
Yeah,
feels familiar.
And the fantasy tradition is itself a kind of a secret conduit for a load of folklore and mythological stuff that has been buried underneath the naturalist tendency in literature, since the 1700s. So in a way, it's this kind of double secret stream of, stories that's survived in these kind of weird forms that's suddenly exploding out in this kind of this utterly unique emanation of Pratchett, in 1983. This is an odd time for it to happen, but I suppose any time would be odd.
Yeah, 80s. It's hard to situate something, I guess, in the 80s.
I find all things that were written in the 80s hard to situate in the 80s. I mean, look at Ian M. Banks and Consider Phlebas. It blows my mind that was written in the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, 80s films I get. 80s music I get.
Yeah, like Brazil.
But 80s sci-fi and fantasy.
What a great film.
It was terrible. Christmas film.
Terrible film.
I was thinking more like Predator or Conan the Barbarian.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Lethal Weapon, or,
Yeah.
Back when films were good.
It is weird that it was the 1980s, but that's where we are. Okay, so then we move to the very opening of the book. Fire roared through the bifurcated city of Ankh-Morpork, where it licked the wizard's quarter. It burned blue and green and was even laced with strange sparks of the eighth colour, octarine. Whereas outriders find their way into the vats and oil stores all along the merchant street, it progressed in a series of blazing fountains and explosions. In the streets of the perfume blenders, it burned with a sweetness. Where it touched bundles of rare and dry herbs in the storerooms of the drug masters, it made men go mad and talk to God. By now the whole of downtown Morpork was alight, and richer and worthier citizens of Ankh on the far bank were bravely responding to the situation by feverishly demolishing the bridges. But already the ships in the Morpork docks, laden with grain, cotton and timber, and coated with tar, were blazing merrily, and their moorings burnt to ashes, were breasting the river Ankh on the ebb tide, igniting riverside palaces and bowers as they drifted like drowning fireflies towards the sea. So this is the introduction to Ankh-Morpork, the city that's at the centre of many of the stories of the Discworld. And it's such a brilliant introduction because, of course, we get all this sense of all of these brilliantly varied districts where lots of interesting and cool stuff is happening. They're all burning down. Which I think is a great way to be introduced to a city.
Yeah, exactly. And in media res as well. I know you've no context at all. But this is, but also just really tantalizing. I mean, you made the point in our last discussion that what a way to start a book with the destruction of like the main feature. But just each sentence is so heavily laden with intrigue and interesting ideas that it's not really a surprise that the next 40 books will keep referring back to the ideas from this initial book. Like every sentence, you could write a book off that.
Yeah.
Every image.
Well, immediately, it's like it actually exists, isn't it? It's like it's so detailed, his imagination and creative imagination, that it's like he's talking about something that actually does exist.
Yeah, it's really impressive when that can happen. Back to film. So I watched Mad Max Fury Road the other day. But like every character was imbued with a sense that it had like a rich and interesting backstory that was completely thought out and fascinating. And like every location, everything was laden with not quite meaning, but with intrigue and interest and depth. And Terry Pratchett does that here.
And I think that the way he does this is, you're absolutely right. And I think that, we talked about this before, that the reason why this city feels immediately real is because, in a sense, it is real, because it is the archetype of a city. It is the essence of city distilled into a single place.
But without being generic, it's got its oddities.
Yes. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
This isn't a lowest common denominator city.
No, you're right. That's a really good point. That's a really good... I hadn't thought about that. You're right. And that, I suppose that's what makes it such an effective archetype of a city, is that it is so specific. So it is both concrete, but also at the same time, it's every city. And I think, doesn't Pratchett actually say that in some of his later novels? Doesn't he actually say that Ankh-Morpork Pork is the sort of the distillation of all the cities of the multiverse? But, that is coagulated on this single sort of... in this single universe, and that's why it's such a kind of happening place. I think he actually says it, which is also very Pratchett, of being that sort of self-aware and meta. But I think that's why it immediately comes across as so real, is because it is, in a sense, it's every city distilled into a single concrete thing.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? And we talked about it in the introduction and in the previous podcast, didn't we? That actually the essence of cities is that they are constantly changing. And they're constantly, nothing stands still. And as such, having it burned down completely, but that not even really be even a particularly significant event within the history of the city. It's just a sort of a fiery comma, as Pratchett himself says. It didn't really stop, didn't really interrupt the life of the history of the city much, just rebuilt and got on with it. That immediately he's honed in on the essence of cities, which is that they're constantly changing and constantly being rebuilt, whereas the countryside is much more static. And that's of course exemplified by Lanka, which doesn't appear in The Colour of Magic yet.
No, but I mean it also appears in the rest of the book, like when you're in rural areas and the middle of the book where you're in the forests and the temples and the the Wormberg. You get a sense that things don't change much there.
Well, in the center of eight, the temple of Belshamaroth, time has actually stood still there while Belshamaroth has been there. And actually, when they defeat Belshamaroth using the flash on Twoflower's camera, the time sort of that's been pent up bursts.
Is released.
Yeah. I think that immediately he's absolutely hit the nature of cities on the head and also introduced us to a fascinating and an interesting place. And then
so we're on page four now.
and then we get Bravd and the Weasel.
The framing story. Because it turns out you can think of The Colour of Magic as four separate short stories or maybe novellas. And the first one has this parody of the fantasy trope of events being told as a story, over a fire, sharing some wine.
Yeah,
I'll pay you some wine for a story, sort of thing. And so the first section of the book is a story within a story, where it's Rincewind saying what's happened and how it led to that fire to Hrun the Barbarian. No, it is Hrun, isn't it?
It's Bravd. It's Bravd.
Bravd. And the very wizard. Different characters.
Yeah. Well, I think I actually had to take a moment to think about which one was which when I was writing up my notes for this, because one gets the sense that Pratchett sort of had they are the sort of the same in his mind as well. But the idea of a story within a story is like, oh, tell me how you got here, and then that launching into the main story is as old as the Odyssey. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but especially in pulp fantasy literature in the 1930s. I mean.
Yeah, well, I think that's because pulp fantasy literature the Odyssey. In the 1930s shares a descent from the Odyssey. I think more truly than many other genres.
Yeah,
exactly. More truly than many naturalistic novels. Absolutely right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, in some ways, one of the reasons why Pratchett feels so weighty is because he does have that heritage. Actually, he's a truer successor to, you know, the likes of Homer and Virgil than the high literature novelists of our day, I would argue, as I argued in our introductory podcast to this series.
Yeah, I mean, it also reminds me of our podcast on hobbies, where you discussed your book. If you were to rewrite that, would it include fancy elements now? I made that link between the Odyssey and...
It included magical realist elements.
Mm.
But as I passionately argued, that's not the same as fantasy, is it? I don't know if I've hoisted my own petard there. But I don't know. I think writing good fantasy is harder than writing... I suspect it would be harder... than writing.
Oh, it's so much harder, because if you're writing naturalistic fiction, you can just write about what you did yesterday.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And which most literary fiction does.
Well, the book that I've been writing for the last 8 years is much more fantastical, you know.
You're right.
Yeah.
and it is much better.
You've seen a sneak preview of. I need to finish that.
Chapter one is a good chapter, I can confirm.
Thanks. Yeah. But anyway, for the readers that are interested in some actual hard knowledge or research about the colour of magic, Bravd and the Weasel are parodies of Fritz Leiber's fantasy heroes Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser in the 1930s.
Have you ever heard of them?
Which is my point. I was talking about the 1930s just now, in case anybody was suddenly confused about that.
Yeah, we can do some editing. Yeah. There'll be a framing device where we start this podcast and all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, exactly. That was a Yeah.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Okay, so we're introduced to them, and they're obviously very funny. They've got the usual sort of charisma of Pratchett's characters. And then Rincewind and Twoflower burst onto the scene, sort of burnt and rather stressed. And then we get the story of how they got there. Which bit do you want to talk about next, Mike? Do you want to talk about when Twoflower arrives to the docks? Or what do you think? Which episode would be next good to chew on?
We're going in pretty deep here. Another half-hour discussion of page six. What haven't we covered that is important in this book?
I do think that we should talk about magic. Can we talk about the demon, the camera, the iconograph?
Yeah, let's talk about that. The amusing reveal where you think it's a real camera. But I think when we first meet Twoflower, he's... You get the impression he's from a world that's driven by technology, and Rincewind rather hopes that he is. Yeah. And he is a clerk in an insurance company. He's trying to introduce the concept of economics and things like that. And so you expect when he lifts up something that looks very much like a camera, it to work like a camera.
Yeah, but Pratchett sets it up brilliantly.
He does.
So brilliantly, because first of all, he has Twoflower... with his what's called an iconograph in the broken drum, and after a brawl, and he gets it out and he starts to take pictures, and he wants pictures of the members of the guard that have come to kind of clean up. And they're all very confused and slightly alarmed. And Rincewind basically translates for them. And he says, they're like, what does he want? And Rincewind says, he's got a box with a demon in it that draws pictures, says Rincewind shortly. Do what the madman says and he will give you gold. And of course, in context, what Rincewind is doing there is he doesn't actually think that. He's just saying something that the men can understand.
Yeah.
And it's a parody of the sort of thing that you would say to some, you know, native islanders or something in the 1950s who had first seen a camera and didn't know what it was and thought it stole a bit of their soul or whatever the sort of the standard story is. It's a parody of what you would say or what they would say. And Westwind is consciously parodying that in order to just get through the situation, even though he thinks or he suspects or he hopes that actually this iconograph doesn't work this way, that it actually is, using something else. Anyway, various events happen. And then Pratchett writes, this is about Rincewind, as the fumes cleared from his brain, he began to speculate seriously as to how the iconograph worked. Even a failed wizard knew that some substances were sensitive to light. Perhaps the glass plates were treated by some arcane process that froze the light as it passed through them. And so Pratchett is leading us down this path of thinking that, you know, Two Flower is a sort of a tourist from a technological and non-magical world, and that actually, you know, this is an actual camera, and it's that, you know, the story is going to be about a sort of a technological person visiting this magical world, and, you know, we're led down that path. Anyway, and then later on, I think the same page, Rincewind tries to take a picture himself. He pulls the lever, and as Pratchett writes, the box said, "It's no good, I've run out of pink." A hitherto unnoticed door opened in front of his eyes. A small, green and hideously warty humanoid figure leaned out, pointed at a colour-encrusted palette in one clawed hand, and screamed at him, "No pink, see?" screeched the homunculus.
And later on we get a description of, you know, there's a bed down there and an easel. There's a fish in a little room.
So the different kind of magic is the fact that they use these little demons, which is exactly what Rincewind did, obviously, said was going on when he was being... So the reader has had their expectations completely reverse undercut. And, I think that bit when the demon screams at him, "No pink," that was the first bit when I first read the book and when I reread it now where I actually laughed out loud. It was just so funny. Because it just so brilliantly plays with your expectations and just the image.
Plus obviously the shame of having taken so many photos of naked young ladies in the whore pits, which is the reason why he's running out of pink. It's a whole load of you got the kind of the long term joke of, you know, his misdirection, and then the short term joke that's because he's taking so many photos of prostitutes.
Later on page 57, Rincewind said, "Hey, look, this is all wrong. When Two Flower said they got a better kind of magic in the Empire, I thought, he's talking to the imp in the camera. The imp looked at him expectantly. Rincewind cursed to himself. "Well, if you must know, I thought he didn't mean magic, not as such. Well, what else is there then?" Rincewind began to feel really wretched. "Don't know," he said. "A better way of doing things, I suppose. Something with a bit of sense in it. Harnessing the lightning or something." The imp gave him a kind but pitying look. "Lightning is the spears hurled by the thunder giants when they fight," it said gently. "Established meteorological fact. You can't harness it." "I know," said Rincewind miserably.
And then later on they describe harnessing, like, literally everyone's trying to understand this idea of putting a harness, towing a wagon behind some lightning.
And he says, no, you can't, you need it to go side to side, but it only goes up and down, and also it would burn the harness. this is obviously this is poking fun at the idea of magic, isn't it? Or is it? I mean, one to think about. So I'll introduce a little quotation from Tolkien, the sort of granddaddy of fantasy, or 20th century fantasy anyway. So in his 1939 essay, On Fairy Stories, he wrote, "If there is any satire present in the tale, one thing must not be made fun of, the magic itself. That must, in that story, be taken seriously. neither laughed at nor explained away. Now, obviously, humour is a massive part of The Colour of Magic, and you can see there with the iconograph, the camera and the imp, that, you know, definitely magic is being used for humorous purposes. But it's more interesting than that, isn't it? So obviously within the sort of the mainstream fantasy tradition, magic is a thing of awe and respect. It's the thing that draws us and delights us, you know, hence the adjective magical. But for Rincewinds, it's dangerous and more importantly, it's unsatisfying. It's tiresome. It annoys him. So it's a completely different attitude towards magic as the one that Tolkien suggested it was essential to the genre. And I think it's actually one of the best parts of The Colour of Magic is where he's upending that perspective and brings us to see that, in fact, our world is just as strange and fantastical as the Discworld. And we see that when, you know, Rincewind talks about harnessing the lightning. Suddenly it makes you think, oh, yeah, actually, that sounds ridiculous. But it is what actually happens in the real world. So actually, which world is strange? And I think that by constantly playing with our expectations, perhaps it brings us to see our reality from the Discworld's point of view. So, you know, he does this by parodying fantasy through applying the absurdity of the real world to it. So in this sense, he gives the Discworld a sense of reality and simultaneously a sense of absurdity to the real world. What do you think of that? I think that's what's going on. So by parodying the fantasy world, by applying the logical strictures of actual reality to it, a la sci-fi, as we were talking about earlier, he does a reversal of the perspective. So he brings the Discworld a sense of reality by applying the strictures of reality to its concepts. And then once he's done that, of course, the implicit comparative world, which is the real world, thus loses its sense of reality because it's been brought over into the Discworld through this kind of parodic element. So the parody actually makes it more real and makes our own world suddenly be the subject of the parody.
Yeah, and there are two points there. One is that, in the real world, I mean, it wouldn't make a difference to most people whether it was a little demon inside a camera or, you know, the actual truth, which, you know, is actually very hard to describe, especially now it's digital. Like, how the hell does a camera sensor work? you know, it wouldn't actually make a difference to many people's lives if it was a demon rather than electronics.
Well, that's true. I mean, do you remember when we first had the internet in our flat and I used to make jokes about sacrificing to the gods when the internet dropped? Because there was no other... I mean, how else... I mean, I have no other mode of control over the strength of the internet, and the internet is extremely important, so it makes perfect sense to sacrifice a goat and hope that it will come back, because there's nothing else I can do.
And then if it works, then...
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
My father was in Iraq once, and they had to transport a generator over a bridge, and it was quite a weak bridge. You know, they're right on the edge of what was sensible.
Yeah.
And so they literally did sacrifice a goat before they crossed the bridge. a large industrial... Yeah.
When you say they, do you mean the Royal Engineers or...
they were working with locals. So,
okay,
funny story. But anyway, the other thing... and, of course, the bridge held up, so...
Yeah, just goes to show.
The other thing is that, when Tolkien says we should be taking magic very seriously, that idolization of magic isn't realistic, because nothing in the real world, is that perfect and wondrous. And as soon as you get up close, like royalty or something like that, you know, you're very quickly disabused of the high notion. So by making it vaguely annoying and unpredictable and unreliable and dirty, you do make it much more realistic than something idealized.
I totally agree with that. And that's another way, actually, as well, in which the sort of the humour that's in Pratchett. His particular humorous, ironic point of view, the humour comes from the accuracy of perception, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the humour of familiarity. Yeah. Yeah, it makes magic feel familiar because it's behaving like everything else that's real in my life.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But more widely, I think, the humour in the whole book comes from the accuracy of perception about the real world. That's where the humour comes from. It's not really coming from the fantasy. It's coming from his accuracy of the perception of the reality of mundane life. Mm. And then it's brought out through the absurdity of the fantastical tropes.
And a lot of his humour relies on that. From different books, but I mean, the Wizards books, you've got a whole load of like committee meetings, and just the very fact of a committee meeting in a fantasy universe.
Yeah.
it's suddenly very funny, even if you're just accurately saying what happens in a committee meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, it's like the world, the Discworld itself is almost partly built out of his particular perspective. And I would say that while, Pratchett is obviously a unique genius, at the same time, he distills, in a very powerful way, what is more broadly a particularly English perspective on the world, which is sort of ironic, sort of a bit cynical, but not overly cynical.
Whilst also being affectionate. Yeah.
Whilst also being affectionate.
I've always heard of English culture being just described as a mixture of Celtic whimsy and Germanic efficiency.
Yeah.
And we are a mix of those two bloodstreams. And so we're a bit whimsical, but we don't get stuff done. Yeah, we're kind of down to earth. We don't believe in these high-fluting theories, but we do believe in fairies,
Yeah. So, in a way, it's a world that's built out of that particular English perspective on life.
It is extremely English, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that's one of the kind of the fundamental forces of this world, is that particular perspective. Yeah, it's like...
Yeah. And so, yeah, this isn't just the shyness of... Yeah, a lot of the settings are quite English.
It is the
outlook on the world, the philosophy expressed.
So I think, I think that's one of the interesting things about it. Well, should we pause there? We thought we were going to do a one podcast episode on The Colour of Magic, but I think we've got to page 40.
I mean, Colour of Magic and the Light Fantastic overlap, and from what I remember from when I last read it, which was probably when I was 14, because I didn't like it very much.
Yeah,
certainly compared to the others, there's some overlap in terms of themes and content as well.
Okay, so should we, instead of doing a sort of 20-part epic on the first book, should we press on with the second book then and just sort of start discussing the two in tandem?
Yeah, see where it takes us. It might still be a 20-episode epic on the first quarter of Colour of Magic, which would be justified.
Yeah, it would be justified.
And we'd be like those YouTubers who do 4-hour videos on each episode of The Mandalorian, criticizing every aspect.
I just don't think The Mandalorian's that good.
Well, nor do these guys.
Yeah.
And they say it very, very eloquently over 4 hours.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I hope you've all enjoyed, if we have any listeners left, our rather...
Yeah, I think we've alienated the weak ones.
Disorganized,
only the strong remain.
Ramble through the first 40 pages of The Colour of Magic, and hopefully you'll tune in again. Hope you do.
Yeah. See you next time.
Bye.